I can't come here and die. I can't come here and live. Got all this shit on my mind. Like, what the fuck am I doing? Work ain't paid me in time. My boo just ripped me my mood. O2 just cut off my line.
Hi, guys.
And welcome to the Echo Chamber.
I'm Jade.
And I'm Iz.
And today we're joined by a special guest who's going to talk to us about the charity sector.
Hi, everybody. I'm Kadra and I'm an organiser for Charity So White.
Hi, Kadra. Thank you so much for coming on. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Charity So White?
Charity So White is a people of colour-led grassroots movement that is seeking to tackle racial inequality and discrimination within the charity sector. We're all a group of volunteer organisers who work in the charity sector, you know, use our lived experience to champion change and anti-racist practice in the sector.
The opening question today is, what is one policy or change that you would implement across the charity sector?
Do you know what? It's such a basic thing, but I think the first step is really acknowledging structural racism within the charity sector. I think the charity sector for too long, and it still is the case that it sees itself as like very progressive and very liberal, and that, you know, of course there's no racism or discrimination within the sector. So people, I think, really need to confront that deep denial that racism exists. And, you know, in order to like tackle any problem, the first step is like to really acknowledge it. So that's what I would say.
How about you, Jade?
Get Black people off the front fucking line and pay them their fucking money. Stop having your Black workers subsisting just above the breadline and working, doing too much work, doing too much. So I think that definitely speaks to what you were talking about, Kadra. But if I'm going to be like really specific, then I think the change that I would want to see in the charity sector is, yeah, just that, like, get Black people off the front fucking line. And what about you, Ev?
Similar to you, Jade, I was thinking it should be mandatory that at least 50% of people at every level of organisation should have lived experience. Yeah, so at least 50% of senior management, of every middle management, and people in the front line, minimum 50% of people with lived experience. From a policy standpoint or from a kind of structural change standpoint, touching on what you said, Jade, about, yes, there are lots of Black and brown people working in the sector, but usually they're not in positions that can impact change when we're thinking about institutional structural racism.
Yeah, 110%. I mean, I'll be really honest and I'll caveat this from the very start of our conversation, this conversation that we're about to have, but like my experience is somewhat limited. Most of my experience is actually in education, so like in schools and universities more specifically. But I did have a period of time where I worked in the charity sector. I worked for an agency and like I just found that it was just full of Black and or ethnic minority people, very much working on the front line, very much like, of course, when you're working for an agency, you don't get the benefits of like secure employment. You don't get like, you don't really get holiday pay, sick pay, all of that sort of stuff. So yeah, I could just see the real disparity, and the job that I was very specifically doing was really hard. It was a really tough job emotionally, sometimes physically. And it was just all Black people. Like it was just all Black people on the front line. Like it just drew my attention to how much things look like that in this sector and others.
Yeah, that rings true to me and my experience. I've only really worked in the charity or fair sector. Never done any other kind of work, to be honest, apart from street fundraising, which was for charities. But apart from that, I've only ever really worked in the third sector. And how this conversation today came about, I was facilitating a series of workshops with an organisation, and they kind of offered it out to their partner organisations, looking at how to develop more racially responsive services within the youth mental health sector. In those workshops, on one of the sessions, Kadra was a co-facilitator, and her, like, how she approached it, our conversations kind of pre and post, and just like generally there is just I always find it really interesting when I meet people in the sector that you just know get it, like you just know that, oh, you get it. There's something about that. Yeah, there's an energy that I get from those experiences and from those encounters. It just made me think about that, the charity sector generally, and we covered this in that training, but the ways that, like, those of us that get it are really out here, like we're really doing the work, like we're really doing stuff to support and make some of the changes. And like Jade's repeated and kept, like, rightfully identified, it is usually us that are in the positions where most harm could be caused, and that's in, like, that's across the whole sector. So that's like physical harm, or that could be like emotionally carrying that burden. So it's usually us that are doing that stuff. So I think it's really important that we are the people that also have conversations about how to change and restructure.
Yeah, exactly. I think I definitely agree with you both in that the, like, charities generally, they don't reflect the communities that they work with. And that's like a huge issue. And as, yeah, just connecting with you, exactly like you said, it was just another person who gets it. And I think, to be honest, there's a growing number and more of us than we think. We're just not as connected. And I think there's a real energy and drive from, you know, young people of colour in the sector to flip things around.
I think back to like youth club days, of course, when I was a lot younger than I am. So we're going back like 15 plus years. I think I was going to youth clubs from like 7 or something. All of the staff were always black as well. Play centre after school, all of the staff were always black as well. And like, quote unquote, management were always white, is one thing that I noticed and thought back to when I was working for a charity. We're working for an agency that had contracts with charities. On what you said there, Kadra, where you were like, oh, there's like more and more of us in the sector. And I just feel like there's like we've always been there. Do you know what I mean? Like, we've actually always been there. But I think that it's more a case of, like, I say this a lot. I say it even in relation to the jobs that I do currently that are not in the third sector or the charity sector. But a lot of this, like, agitating for change and having the time and the space to, like, advocate for oneself or advocate for the group is not the privilege that we have. And it's because it's in and of itself an emotional strain. It's an emotional burden. It's burdensome. Do you know what I mean? Like, to be writing letters, writing emails, going to meetings, joining the union that costs £10 a month, all of these things, like, it takes something out of you that you just don't have sometimes when you're from these particular very specific socioeconomic backgrounds. So I think maybe perhaps what the change is that we're seeing and that, like, I'm here for is more like finding that space and time and understanding why you need to find that space and time to be writing the emails, to be writing the letters, to be going to the meetings, to be joining the unions, and etc, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of our sort of like key messages that we try and push out there in Charity So White is, like, we don't talk about diversity and inclusion, we talk about power and privilege. And we all have power and privilege, whether we're white, black, LGBT, whatever kind of characteristic or protected characteristic you have, you know. And so for me, for someone who has worked their way up within the charity sector, I felt that it was important for me to use my position and influence to raise these things now that I am there. Like as I've only ever worked in the charity sector, coming up to nearly 10 years, I started off working in practice with young people, and for all the sort of like challenges you guys already talked about, I got a bit frustrated with that. And I was like, you know what, like, what is this space around like policy and research? And, you know, how comes it's predominantly white middle-class people who are basically making policy that has the impact on the ground? And so I just pursued like an internship. I had an unpaid internship and 2 part-time jobs. I was basically working like 6 to 7 days a week just so that I could get into that field. It was a long and hard journey, but eventually, you know, one charity and somebody within it gave me a chance and gave, you know, fought for me to get a role there. I've always felt in the more kind of like strategic side of the charity sector, I've always felt like I'm one of like very few people of color in that space altogether. You know, I've been in directorates where it's been like 80 people or so in it, and I've been the only person of color in it. And it's like, you know, you're working on poverty, you're working on, you know, criminal youth justice, you're working on refugee and migrant young people, and why is it so white? You know, obviously with that comes all the kind of like microaggressions and interpersonal experiences of racism stuff. It's a huge problem, but I think it's up to some of us in these positions of power to like not pull the ladder up and like actually connect more with communities, connect more with people on the front line and actually relay their concerns, because I get it. I see the issues that are happening on the front line and just the inequalities around pay and respect and power in terms of like informing programs and whatnot. It's something, at least for me, I'm very committed to like bringing it to the table and also bringing those people along with me to the table.
So as you were speaking then, Kadra, there was like literally like 20 different thoughts that came to my mind in terms of like what angle to go next. Basically, one thing that I'm really aware as we're having this conversation is that we are three Black women that have a context and understanding. So when we say things like, oh, microaggressions or inequality in pay or whatever, that's just those facts and that reality is very understood by us. I'm aware that for many people, they aren't even aware of the issue. So there will be people listening to this that don't any real way. So maybe they've read a report or they've heard a little bit about inequality. They've done a diversity and inclusion training. So then, yeah, they get it, but they don't get it. Like they don't understand actually how the gravity, the depth of the issue. So there's that. And then from that, I'm very aware that like, because we're talking from this context and because we know and understand, I often get frustrated when I speak to, I'm going to call them outsiders. So I'm going to call, when I speak to people that aren't othered or people that aren't racialized. So my frustration, so I can have these conversations, I can hold these conversations with people that are like-minded, but then to start the education and to start teaching white people that they're racist or teaching white people that they have got significant privilege over me. So even in terms of like entry points into the sector, as you just described, yours, Kadra, mine was not too dissimilar. Like it wasn't as simple as I'd rock up at an interview because I'm from Surrey and I'm a middle-class white woman. My godfather is friends with the CEO of this charity. That wasn't my experience. So, and that, again, not to say that that's all white people's experiences or all white people's entry points into it, but I guess it's just me understanding that I am speaking from a very specific context, and where I'm speaking from, there is no doubt in my mind that these issues are recurring because it's my experience. It's not a question, it's more of a like observation, is that there will be lots of people that don't understand. So when we say things like microaggressions or some of the issues that we've raised, there will be many people that don't really understand what that is. That's what I don't really have time for. That's why I've gone freelance, and I don't work for white people anymore, that I can't, because it's the labor. And like I've worked for some really nice white people but the labor involved in like doing the structural organizational change, like it falls on my head, and I'm never adequately remunerated for it. That like, I've never had an experience. So every organization since I became, like since I stepped out of the box and I stepped out of, and I started to understand that the charity sector to me often imitates the plantation blueprint. And there's often a white master at the top giving directions and people are kind of working underneath them to meet the aims that they have thought would serve communities that they're usually not from. Once I understood that and stepped out of it and started to attempt to do the work to make those changes, I realized that the bulk of that work always lands on me. However, I've never been in a senior management position, or I've never been paid the level that I deserve to be paid to do that structural change work.
Yeah, I mean, all of that just spot on and very, very powerful. There's actually a book about this that's based on the charity sector in the US, but it refers to the charity sector as the not-for-profit industrial complex. And it is an industrial complex, to be honest with you. I'm totally with you. It's not for us as people of color to be educating white people about racism. And if I tell you a little bit about like Charity So White and how that came about, Charity So White is like a public-facing campaign that really is about revealing, lifting a lid on the charity sector's dirty little secret, which is racism. So I saw like the hashtag when it initially came about in like the summer of 2019, followed like a really scandalous incident at Citizens Advice Bureau, which is a big national charity that works with lots of like disadvantaged quote unquote communities. You know, they had a training program for all their volunteers. And within that, they had like a slide pack that had some information about barriers that volunteers need to keep in mind when working with Black and Black, Asian and minority communities. It was just ridiculous. The slide had things in there like, you know, we have high levels of illiteracy, we're too cash centric, we're too family centric, we've got like warped gender values, all this stuff that was like completely baseless. And like in 2019, you would think these things are not happening. It was just like the most bizarre, stereotypical BS. But like for white people, they were surprised by it. But for people like us, I'm sure we were not surprised by it, because we see that very much playing out in the charity sector through all their work. And then the day that I launched, there was like over 3,000 people sharing their personal experiences. You know, you have someone who works in a criminal justice charity going to events, and because they're a young Black guy, they're being asked, oh, so when did you leave? When did you leave prison? And all that kind of stuff. And even if they did, what is the problem? Like, you know, again, like you're saying, people, we should be valuing lived experience a lot more in the sector than we do. Like you say, as it's not just about these kind of like interpersonal experiences. It's also about how structural racism is actually, like, the charity sector is somewhat founded within it. There's a lot of like colonial legacies with charities, and like thinking about the idea of missionaries. And, you know, we still see the white saviorism playing out and harming lots of communities of color. And I think a lot of the time, the public conversations around it, like focus on international development and like Stacey Dooley and Ed Sheeran going to Africa and stuff. But it's like, no, this very much exists domestically as well. And like within youth services, we see how a lot of charities talk about youth crime, and like some of the programs and interventions they come up with are really racist and actually perpetuate the problem. They don't really want to get into the root drivers of issues like youth crime, like poverty and all the other factors that face, you know, young people. It's just more about kind of like maintaining the status quo and having programs that basically have little to no impact because they're just so far removed and disconnected from communities. So, you know, that's kind of where we came about from. And, you know, it initially started off by charities like just acknowledging structural racism exists, and like really for them to like reflect on what they're willing to give up, because something has to give. Like, none of us are having it anymore. We're going to keep holding you to account. And that's how we were sort of founded.
I've got to say, Kedra, you actually, so in what you just said, so, you know, when we first initially came into the conversation, I don't know why, but I was just really thinking about like charities nationally. So like charities on the ground in Britain, and I was definitely speaking from that place. But you just said something about like the international context and looking at international development. And that is like very much my academic field, politics, international development, looking at development, particularly on the continent in Africa, taking that into consideration and broadening that the context of this conversation. Like, it almost makes me feel a little bit overwhelmed for you and the work that you're doing with charities so well and the people that you're working with, because it's kind of like this thing is big. Like, this is such a big thing, and it's so mad, and it's so pervasive, and it like it impacts people in very different ways. So it's like I was talking about the frontline stuff with Black people, and I was definitely thinking very much like about the UK. Actually, when we consider the way that it looks like internationally, the whole thing is white. So it's like the people on the front line, the decision makers, they are all white. People that are doing the frontline stuff, as much as those that are making the decisions, it's all harmful. It's really harmful when we consider like what happened in Haiti, and I'm sure, and the Oxfam scandal, and all of the things that like go unsaid, unspoken, like that we don't know about. And it just kind of brings to the fore like how massive this whole conversation is, and how like how much work there is to do, how many lids there are that need to be, like how many proverbial lids need to be lifted.
Yeah, no, it is huge. And you know, like I say, like a lot of this like came about during the period of colonialism, like around the world. So like that's how we see it playing out internationally. You know, and even in the US, lots of charities and organizations doing a lot of work around like this whole reparations movement. It's like a big global debate and shake up. But I think like for me, that what the interesting thing about it is that, like, it's always white people helping Black people and brown people, and it's been ineffective for far too long. And I think, I don't know why it's taken people so long to sort of wake up to that, because in the UK, we kind of saw some of this like in the 80s when they had like the Band-Aid movement. There were some like initial conversations about like, oh, this is a bit kind of like racist. Like, even, you know, the song that hits number one every Christmas around Let Them Know It's Christmas Time, these things are like sort of common knowledge. It is overwhelming. And I think it's not up to us to like necessarily find the solutions to these things. This is very much like white people's problem. And like, you know, we're here to kind of like share our concerns, our lived experience. And, you know, you guys need to fix yourselves up and, you know, check your own people. That's, you know, we're here to like facilitate that. And, you know, there are some things they can do, like, as, you know, I really like your idea about 50% of organizations being lived experience people. The solutions is something that I think is still very much emerging. And, you know, people ask us all the time, can you like point to examples or charities that have got something right? And it's like, no, I can't. I can if they are led by Black people. The reason why they are effective is because they're led by Black people. So yeah, there's not a single like white organization that, you know, out there that is doing anything right. Yeah, the last year has been quite interesting to see how people responded to, you know, the murder of George Floyd and COVID. And it's like a lot more on people's radar. And, you know, we're listening and watching, is this lip service or are you actually going to lead and lead like real tangible change?
Essentially what you were saying about it not being our work and our job, like, yeah. And like, I hear it. It is the work and the job of white people to, like, this decolonization work is, it's not us to picking up the pieces basically and to be like agitating to be able to usher reform in. It needs to be white people that are doing the work, because yeah, like as you said, what it was based upon is this whole colonial imperial industrial complex, I guess. What I would say though, so I'm sure that I've like mentioned this anecdote before in the podcast, but I remember being in university doing my master's, we were talking about charities, actually we were talking about charity work, and we were just considering like on a policy level the most important things that need to like be considered on a policy level, and we kind of had to stream things in order of importance and whatever. And what I was arguing kind of against the grain was that, like, I think ethics was like one of the most important things to consider. I was being challenged by my colleagues, but then I was in the end also challenged by the lecturer, like, oh, why, like, why is that so high up? No, actually, sorry, I was actually arguing that ethics should come lower down. And I was being challenged by the lecturer on that, and he was kind of like, no, like, people need ethics, they need to be told what to do, essentially. And I was sort of like, why does a human being need to be told what's right and what's wrong? A human being knows what's right and what's wrong, basically. And then we got into a conversation about Oxfam stuff, which was had just come out at the time. I was just kind of like, so why does somebody need to be told not to be a prick? Like, why does somebody need to be told not to be an abuser? And he got really offended. He was really angry. He was really angry that I had used a swear word.
Because it was his brethren.
He actually was like, the way that they're behaving is like humans, that like, this is how humans behave kind of thing. And it was just like, this lecturer was able essentially to silence me, because I didn't say nothing else because no one was backing me. You're moving like that through the world with impunity. And as you rightly said, that was my first thought, it's your mates. It's your brethren that probably work for Oxfam, do you know what I mean? Like, you've taken the academia route, that's their thing. That's what they're doing. They work in the charity sector. And they're doing mad things, do you know what I mean? And it's just like, in that one conversation, in that one comment, I attempted to like confront or to lift the proverbial lid on the fuckery, and it was essentially slammed back down, like, how dare you? But I do think like that there is a work, or there is a place for us in louding things up, basically.
It was working in the third sector that taught me the depth and the insidious nature of many white people's madness. like I didn't know before. I didn't actually understand the depth of it because I used to, so I knew what racism was and I knew about like racism or people that didn't like me or whatever, and people that were kind of overtly either just dumb or dumb, racist, cool, whatever. I knew I had had those experiences in childhood, but I think coming into the third sector and working with white liberals taught me that like the level of privilege and like, so even what you've just spoken about, the level of privilege, the level that their networking, they're like, it's literally just one big like machine. They all generally speaking, like it's a massive machine that is perpetuating the same type of racism that you find outside of the sector, actually worse, because it's with smiley white people that will cry when you tell them that they're being racist, or it's with white people that genuinely believe they're doing the Lord's work. And so because of that, they're above scrutiny, they're above being challenged when it comes to some of the ways that they discriminate against others. On what you've just said, Jade, when I think about that, the mass, like when I was young and bright-eyed, I used to really want to do like international development work, or like, I don't know, work for the UN or something like that. That was like the dream. I'm going to go to Africa and I'm going to fix Africa. And I wonder where I learned that from. But anyway, so that was like my, that was the dream. That was the goal, that if you learn enough about Africa and if you go to Africa, this place, you can really make changes and you can do lots of meaningful work. And don't get it twisted, I'm not saying that like people can't do meaningful work on the continent, but it's working in the sector and understanding the layers of the fuckery that I realised, oh, I definitely cannot identify a single Western organisation that is doing that well, or that is doing that in a way that isn't problematic. I personally have never come across one, and I've worked with many, so I've never come across one. And then like just understanding the bureaucracy and just the red tape and just the many, many barriers that are in place to do that type of work well, with integrity and in a way that isn't problematic or colonial. I was like, okay, I can't do that. I can't do that. My mental health won't survive that. So then, yeah, so a lot of my work that I do has been UK based. And understanding like all of the barriers that we face here and all of the like just the shit that we have to put up with in order to do that work led me to be like, I'm not doing this. I'm leaving the sector. So there's a racial justice activist called Deepa Iyer. And recently one of my amazing colleagues, Molly, introduced me to their work. And they have something called Social Change Ecosystem, or a Social Change Map. And it just puts kind of the different positions or the different roles. I will not be able to remember all of them. There's quite a few. But the different roles that people play when doing social justice work or anti-racism practice. And there are three that like really stick out to me. So, and I think it's storyteller, healer, and disruptor. And when I think about the role that I play currently and the roles that I want to play moving forward, actually, things change in it. So I don't know if I want to forever play these roles. But I think where I'm at in my career now, I see myself as a storyteller, as a healer, and as a disruptor. Like all the other stuff. So all of the like, and in that, like my hope and my dream is that there will be other people that can do more of the either the frontline work or the strategic work or the building or like the different things that need to come into place to make the changes that we want to see. I had to learn my lane. I had to learn where I get energy from. I had to learn what is sustainable work for me is. Like, what can you do? Because trying to attack the big monster, it's too big. Like, it's too big. It's too insidious. It's too set in stone. It's overwhelming to even think about, like, where do I even start? Like, we've identified here that, are we talking about domestic issues? Are we talking about international work? Are we talking about frontline workers? Are we talking about policies? Are we talking about structures? Are we talking about, like, what are we talking about? And like whiteness invades and poisons every single layer of that work. So I think for me, one of the ways that I can continue to like just not become fully ignorant, and this is just me being very transparent here, it would be very easy for me to just become really ignorant and be like, I'm not working with white people. I'm not working with white people. And I don't feel safe enough to work because of my experiences. I don't feel safe enough to work with white people full stop when it comes to anything to do with social justice work because I don't trust them. That would be a really easy thing to do. But what has made me challenge that But I do believe that that would be ignorant. And what has made me challenge that is knowing my lane. So knowing, oh, do you know what? This is what I can bring. This is what I can do. These are my boundaries. These are the parameters within which I'm willing to work. And that's going to be on my terms. I've been in the sector my first ever job was when I was quite young. So I've been in the sector for coming up to 15 years. I can't anymore. I've done it. I've tried. I've worked with. But I can't. So I know what I can do is I can tell stories. I can tell my story. I can tell the story of people from my community. And that is through different mediums. In terms of like doing the healing work, I do that through self-healing and sharing practices that I hope will support others to do the same. And I can disrupt. I will forever disrupt. I will forever agitate. I will forever challenge. And those are the things that I know that I can do. That social change map was super helpful for me to be like, okay, this is where I fit within this bigger fight.
Yeah, I love that. I would love to see it as well afterwards. Absolutely everything what you just said, I echo it. And I think, like, for me personally, I'm just naturally, I guess, like an empathetic person, you know, the oldest of like four kids. I had to like look after them and stuff. So like, I've always been like somebody who likes to like help people and defend people, even though that's kind of like twisted in itself in some ways. But as like Black people and people of color generally in the charity sector, we also have like our communities like maybe questioning us as well in terms of like why we are working in the sector. Like my parents were like, oh, you know, you went to uni, you did all of this, why do you want to work in a charity? There's no money in it, you know. So there's also like within our community, it's not seen as a bit of like a desirable thing alongside all of the challenges when we are within it. So it's a interesting sort of like space to be in. A lot of like overworking, burnout. And I think people generally in the charity sector face this because, you know, again, people think they're doing good work. But as a, you know, Black woman in this space as well, I feel like I've had to learn to put up boundaries and not only in anti-racism work, but just in work generally, because I think there's that like temptation because you feel like you're doing something good, you should like continue working to the ground. And like a lot of people have seen that with COVID. But I guess with COVID, in some ways, it's brought about a bit of a focus for us, because we started off, you know, talking about racism. There wasn't that many charities engaging in our work initially, very few like took us seriously. And then the pandemic came and then people were like, oh, you know, we need to think about like the inequalities that might emerge from it and all of that. And so like we kind of like pivoted towards like thinking about what does a response to COVID that centers racial justice look like, and can we like start that conversation early? Everything that we have seen in terms of like the disproportionate impact on Black communities and whatnot, like we could have all predicted that. Like we already knew a lot of like people of color faced inequalities before the pandemic. So I don't know why it was like a surprise to people. And like, you know, just as like volunteers, we came together to like put a paper, just put in all of the evidence around all of these like pre-existing inequalities and made some calls to the charity sector to think about from the very kind of early stages, how they acknowledge these issues and like what actions they take to like mitigate against them. I think there's something like 65,000 redundancies in the charity sector. Who do you think that's going to impact on the most, right? Of course, it's going to be like the Black and brown people on the front line. If they have to make cuts, it's never going to be like the CEOs or like the people at the top. And like another area we focused on is funding, because within all of this, even though it can seem like overwhelming, like the challenges in the charity sector, you have to like follow the money too. Like, where does the charity sector get its money from, right? And like, what stipulations are there around funding? So we kind of like, we looked at things like Grenfell and the response to Grenfell and the fact that the money didn't go to the Black organizations in the community and the Muslim organizations in the community who worked with a lot of those families. It went to the big mainstream charities to do the work. And we didn't want the same to happen with COVID. So we had like this call for like ring fence funding for BAME led charities. And you know what? Some of the funders actually did it. And that was a pleasant surprise to us. So like Comic Relief, they had a 20% ring fence on all of their emergency funding for COVID. They even released a big program of funding called like the Global Majority Fund, you know, Lloyds Bank Foundation, Lottery, National Emergencies Trust, loads of these funders, like they're starting to like wake up to their role and their complicitness in racism in the charity sector. And, you know, it's up to them. I think, again, there's a real lack of like knowledge and understanding about racism within the funding world itself. We have been actually able to kind of guide them and get them to like ask the right questions of charities. So, you know, we don't want it to be a tick box exercise that you say, oh yeah, you know, we deliver services to X many Black people in this area, like actually show us what change. And, you know, do you, as you're a large charity, need to be the one that applies for it yourself? Like, what are you doing to work with those grassroots organizations? So the funding thing in itself is like a big minefield, but it's something we've been focusing on as well.
Yeah, I've got a mate who is just flipping amazing. They're very annoying, but they're amazing. And they are like taking the funding within the sector by storm at the moment. They're just very much asking lots of these questions and like doing lots of work to understand the funding element. I agree with you completely about the need to follow the money and for that to be able to kind of one, validate and prove a lot of the things that we are saying, but also to disrupt that process. Even within that, so one of the reasons that I set up an organization some years back, which I like sometimes work under. Generally speaking, I work as self-employed, but sometimes work under that organization. I am very reluctant to like grow it. Reason being is because that process just makes me uncomfortable of this idea. And this is very personal to me. I get it and I understand that like the need and the importance of kind of fighting for funding for Black-led organizations or organizations led by minoritized groups. But within that, to me, it still very much feels that we are knocking on the door with our hands out, trying to prove and say, oh, please, like, give us something, help us with this. And yes, we need to do that. So again, to be very clear, I'm not saying that we don't need to do that. But I guess in my position, I'm just really aware of how that feeds into and perpetuates some of the fuckery as well. So there just doesn't feel that there's a way out, to be honest, for me. And there doesn't feel that there's a way out. So knowing and understanding, like, like my sanity in my work comes from knowing and understanding my role, my capacity, my limitations, and what I can do and what I can bring. But one thing that I think is beautiful, and it touches on what you spoke about earlier, Kedra, that there are more of us than we think. So there are so many kind of talented and just like all round amazing individuals that are doing their work, whatever that might be. So whatever their roles are, and it will be different from mine, like whatever their roles are in the organizations that they're working for, they're doing their work. And I am seeing ever so slight shifts based on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like we're creating our own version, not an old boy network, but we're creating our own network. And it's something we've not had before as a community. And just knowing that there's like other Black women that I can turn to and, you know, ask for support and that sort of thing. Like that is what we've, you know, lacked and what's disempowered us. And, you know, something we have been doing at Charity So White is we've started delivering free training called Building Our Collective Power for people of color who are represented within race equality networks or BAME networks within the charity sector to really like recognize the collective power basically that they have and like how they can work to hold organizations to account. Like over the last year or so, we've seen so many of these networks coming together and some even including white people within them, challenging like allegations of racism, misconduct, really holding CEOs to account and, you know, stepping on their necks about all of the work they're doing on anti-racism. So it's just that lack of like organizing, I think, has maybe made us all feel like we're the only ones who feel this way, but it's not really the case.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I hear you. And I think that it is important to raise up that there are a limited amount of white allies that are working alongside us, and that actually, I genuinely don't think any work can be achieved without like everybody being on like lots of different people at the table. Basically, I think that's when humanity, we're at our strongest, when we're working with difference and when we're working with people that aren't like us. So it is important to lift up that there are white people that are doing what they can, doing their part within that. Yeah, my hope and prayer is that we continue to work in ways that are sustainable for us. So that's it. Like when I think I'm trying to focus a lot less on the quote unquote work, because I think my experience growing up, I saw so many black women working in the sector or working in caregiving roles that now, that just didn't get to do the work on themselves and their families because they gave everything to the community. And I can see the damage that has done to them on a personal level. So I guess my prayer and my hope for black people working to create change in the world is that we will find ways to do it that are sustainable, that we won't center the work above the real work, which is like ourselves, like working on ourselves, growing in ourselves, being comfortable in ourselves, that will be central to our practice, that collective care will be the thing that grounds us, but also the thing that we prioritize over some of the agendas that we have, because it's just not sustainable in any other way. That's my hope. I was going to ask you two, what is your hopes?
I don't think that I have any hopes that are dissimilar from what you've said there, kind of piggybacking a bit off of what you said, and then also piggybacking on my point that I made in the beginning. Perhaps my hope for the sector more generally and for Black, brown people within the sector, doing the work in the sector, is that they will be properly remunerated, that they will be given the positions as well, and that there will be more people taking up space if they so wish, or where they so wish, in decision-making capacities, directing policies, and essentially being at the helm of a lot of needed change within the sector. So I think that's my hope. And yourself, Kadra?
Yeah, definitely agree with both of you on that. I think our sort of three key sort of principles are around honesty, humility, and hope. Like we didn't set ourselves up to like tear the charity sector down, because we all work in it. We want things to be effective as much as possible. And for me, I hope that we are really beginning to shift the dial on this. And, I would want to see a lot more charities and organizations led by racialized communities. That's what I would want. And for them to focus on the issues that matter to them most and get recognized. And in an ideal world, really, we should even have a charity sector in some ways, because, public services would be doing what they needed to do. And, we wouldn't have a charity sector that's there to pick up the slack because government is failing to recognize these things. And so I would want, in the first instance to have a charity sector that is really effective, understands the issues, and then puts that responsibility back onto statutory services and, and for them not to be picking up the real kind of specialist work that government should be doing. I don't know how I feel about it. I'm still thinking about it, because I think there's definitely value in people not going to government organizations. But a lot of the problems are things that I think can be resolved through better policies around things like poverty, food poverty, education, etc., if we had a real kind of caring and compassionate government.
No, I 100% agree with you. And I think in there's so many of the points that you're making, Kadra, I'm just seeing how this conversation is so deep and broad and almost unending as well. From a political standpoint, we definitely aligned, because I think I do feel similar that beyond it being perhaps very far more community focused and maybe more culturally specific, I don't know how I feel about charities and the actual necessity, particularly when we look at Britain today, contemporarily, austerity Britain, when we look at Britain under the Conservatives, people are very dependent on the work of charities and the way that charities are operating and the growing impunity that they're able to operate with because of their structures and because of the conservative nature of a lot of this government's policies. Like, it is essentially making a bad situation worse and not rectifying, like, the heart of the issue.
Yeah, 100%. I just wanted to add, like, I guess we're starting to see a bit of, like, a reckoning now because of that really ridiculous race and ethnic disparities report the government put out last week. You know, like, the charity sector is not having it, and it is actually Black and brown people who are leading this fight. You know, there's this big open letter that charities like Ubele Initiative, Runnymede Trust, Race and Agenda, Charity So White as well, have coordinated this big open letter. And I think within 24 hours, it had like over 2,000 signatories from people in the charity sector. So let's hope, you know, they keep up the pace and keep up, you know, checking government in this way, because I think we've been a bit fearful as a sector to challenge what we know and hold government to account over what we know is true. Like, for them to be saying racism isn't a thing, you know, come on.
I think I'm an anarchist. Yeah, I think I'm an anarchist. I'm a pessimist and definitely a pessimist. And I think that makes me a bit of an anarchist, because I'm just like, burn it all down to blood clot. That's where that's the stage that I've reached. So even like here, and that's why the thing that I have hope for is about the individual or the collective care of us. I don't even the systems, the government, all of that, burn it all down, fireburn every single one of them. Because as far as I'm concerned, like Jade and I very intentionally haven't spoken about the race something that they tried to do the other day. We haven't really even spoken about it off air. We literally were just like, us, the fuck we finish. Because for my sanity and for I refuse, beyond a retweet here or there, if I see something that resonates, I refuse to engage with that fuckery and that level of fuckery. I categorically refuse to be denied my human rights in that way. And so when you're talking about, when you brought in government, you bring in all the, I'm just like, burn it, everything, like all of them just need to burn, everything just needs to burn. But obviously that's not a practical way to engage with it. And so practically I need to just know my lane. But for me, somebody like me, my mental health is already on the edge. Mm. I can't, I cannot for the life of me do that work. I categorically refuse. So for everybody that is in those spaces, that is pushing that change forward, that is challenging in that way, like, more power to you. My hat's off, honestly, like, my heart goes out to you, because I don't know where you get the strength to do that work. I couldn't do it. For me, burn it down. Burn all of them.
I completely agree with you. I think it's really, really demoralizing. For me, it's like, you know, thinking about the fact that, you know, in 15, 20 years time, someone's going to pick this up and use it as an excuse for some BS. Like, no, you know, and like, for me, it's the institutions, like the charities as institutions challenging it. Like, that is good to see, because it's like, you know, on most things, you're not calling them out. You're not really calling them out on like the hostile environment, all of these things this government is doing. Like, there's no, because people are worried about their own pockets. And that's why it all comes back to money, which is the world we live in, isn't it? Unfortunately. And I think in this Englandia, if we are here, like, there's certain parameters that we are within. But I think, I mean, yeah, our approach thus far is like looking at the little changes that can help us make the big change and getting people on board along the way to do some of that work. Because it is exhausting, it is draining, it's emotional labor. And yeah, I don't blame you from disengaging, you know, from all of it, to be honest.
So Kadra, where can people find you? Where can people find Charity So White?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter, at Kadra, KADRA underscore A. And then Charity So White is at Charity So White. And we've got a website as well, which I think is charitysowhite.org.
We will link all of the handles in the description box anyway, for people to have a look. But thank you so much for your time, and guys, we'll catch you in the next one.
I can't come here and die. I can't come here and lose. Got all this shit on my mind. Like, what the fuck am I doing? Work ain't paid me in time. My brain just ripped in my mood. OT. tattoo just cut off my life.